Through the last three chapters, we've been studying the account of Noah and God's flood. A little over 1,500 years after creation, mankind had grown increasingly wicked, and God determined to blot out mankind from the face of the earth, along with all the other living creatures. God showed favor to Noah. Noah walked with God. So Noah was chosen by God as his instrument of preserving and replenishing life on the planet. He instructed Noah to build an ark. And when the time came, Noah and his family, along with two of every kind of animal, were carried safely through the deluge. After a week of waiting, 40 days and nights of torrential storms with waters released from above and below, 150 days of saturation, 150 days of the waters receding, another couple of months waiting for the ground to dry and for God to call them out, over a year spent in the ark. Last week, we saw Noah's first priority after departing the ark. It was to offer a burnt offering unto the Lord. It was a full commitment of his life in gratitude for God's saving mercy, a recognition of his own sin and his need of God's sovereign grace. And he did this through the blood and the life of a substitute. And when the Lord smelled this offering, it was a pleasing aroma. And God said in his heart, "I'll never again curse the ground because of man." We pick up this morning in our study at Genesis 9, verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply. Increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it." Last week, at the end of chapter 8, in the aftermath of God's judgment, as Noah and his family came off of the ark with all of the animals, the first thing he did is he worshiped the Lord, and he made offerings that were pleasing to God. Noah had been carried safely through God's great flood, not because he was sinless, but because God had showed him favor, grace. And when he spoke to Noah, Noah believed him, and he obeyed him. Noah knew that he deserved the judgment of this flood as much as everyone else that was around him. He deserved this blotting out. But in God's grace, when God came to him, he believed him. He trusted God. And so when he got off the ark, he spilled the blood and he offered unto God a burnt offering of every clean animal and bird, and it went up as a pleasing aroma to the Lord. This was pleasing to God. To see this trust that Noah had of him. And so on top of his grace that he had already given to Noah in carrying him through the flood, on top of that grace, he places another grace. It moved God's heart. God committed that he would never curse the ground in this same way again for the wickedness of men. Even though in that section it shows that he knew that the wickedness was still there. That Noah and his sons were going to beget sinful kids and sinful generations, and that the sin problem wasn't going to be taken care of. But in the midst of it, with this substitutionary atonement that God was making, there would be those in every single one of these generations that he would love, that he would save. And so then he promises that We can trust this, and this is what's called God's common grace to all men. This is a promise that was made to all of Noah's generations and to all of the animals. As long as the earth remains, which means from the time of Noah even through today, this is a promise that's even for all of us. This is the promise that we can trust that the sun will rise and it will set. The seasons will come and they will go on schedule. There'll be times of planting and times for harvest. There'll be cold and heat, summer and winter, and God will keep this cycle going until the end, until Christ comes again. He guarantees it. Knowing in the hearts of man every intention is evil from youth to old age, sinners, every single one of us. But as Jesus taught, our Father who is in heaven makes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. God's common grace given to all until that day that's fixed when he'll judge the world at the return of Christ, destroying not just the land and the creatures this time, but will establish a whole new heavens and earth. And so upon grace, we come to verse 1 in chapter 9, and we see yet another grace. If you look here right at the very beginning, verse 1, it says, "And God blessed Noah and his sons," as if they hadn't been blessed already. And now we have another specific blessing that's coming to Noah and his sons. You know, in Genesis chapter 1, verses 21 and 22, when God had made the whales and every living creature in the water and all the birds of the air, do you remember what it told us? It said that God blessed them. He blessed the whales and the fish. He blessed the birds of the air. And he told them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the skies." What did he bless them? He blessed the fish with all of the waters, and he blessed the birds with all of the skies. "Here's what I have. I give it to you. Fill it." And then if you remember in Genesis 1:28, after he created Adam and Eve, what did he do? He blessed them. In recalling the generations of Adam to Noah in Genesis 5, again, we're reminded that when Adam and Eve were first created, still in a state without sin, God blessed them. And what did he tell them? "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. I've created this for you. Fill it. Use it." And so we come to chapter 9, verse 1. And it's one thing to understand that God was blessing his creatures and that first man and woman before the fall, sinless at that time, pre-fall condition, living in communion with one another and in communion with him. You can understand that blessing. But now, after the fall, after 1,500 years of increased wickedness, after he had to come and judge and destroy all life, still knowing that mankind was full of sinfulness and still living in a corrupted place with hearts so prone to evil, here, after all of this, God blessed Noah and his sons, and told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. We use this term a lot, blessing, to bless. God blesses us. God bless you. I'm going to bless God. God blesses me. We use that term a lot, but I bet if I took a survey, it'd be hard for you to define what that word means. We kind of have an idea of what it means. The very opening verse that we had this morning, "Bless the Lord, O my soul." Bless the Lord. What did he mean? We kind of understand when God blesses us, but how do we bless him? We speak of God's blessings to us, and we don't fully understand what they mean. I want to bring that out for us a little bit this morning. The Hebrew word for blessing is kneeling. And the picture that it points to is one showing deference. What's deference? Not difference, deference. Deference is a giving of respect. It's showing that what is it, what you're kneeling to has value. The kneeling, it puts a height on the one that's receiving this deference. It lifts them to show that they have a special status. In the military, I was in the military, some of you were in the military, when an officer or someone of rank would come into a room, we would stand. We would stand and we would show them deference. And we would give them respect. It wasn't that we weren't equal in our manhood, in who we were as humans, but what it meant was because of this rank, because of this, they had a special value to us, and so we would stand in their presence and we would give them respect. It's not a sign of height as one someone being better than another. It's not like a kneeling before a king, like a peasant coming before a king, hat in hand, kneeling, because if that were the case, trust me, God would not bless you. It's given to show value, to set you apart. That he, God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, is giving a respect to you. It's amazing to think about. You know, I was taught when I was young that when a woman would come to the table or leave the table, you would stand. Today we don't see that very much. They think it's somehow demeaning to a woman for a man to stand at the table. Because they think in the definition that this means that one's not equal to the other. It has nothing to do with the equality. It's to say you have a special place in my heart. I value you. I have a respect for you. And at a time when I was growing up, when women weren't respected very much, it was a way for a husband and for a father, for a son to respect that woman, to say, I respect you. I have great value for you. It was something that was beautiful, not ugly. We've lost that in our culture. We'll talk a little bit about that later. So the Hebrew for blessed begins with kneeling, deference. But also in this picture, it's not just kneeling and showing deference. It's always attached with the giving of something. Giving something fitting to this relationship. As I talked about the officer, you're giving respect. You're giving honor to the woman. You're giving respect. You're giving honor. The Lord blessed the fish and the birds. And when he did that, he wasn't kneeling before the birds and the fish. What he was doing was letting all his creation know, I value them. I have a respect for everything that I have created. It all has value. And I give them the sky. I give them the clouds. I give them their perch. Go read Job. I feed them. I care for them. Don't we know something about how God cares for birds? If one little sparrow falls to the earth, it does not fall without our God's care. He cares about that. That's something I want you to take with you today, to understand our God cares when a little swallow, when a little bird, one little bird falls to the ground. He cares. Lord blessed Adam and Eve. He valued them. He set them apart. He favored them, and he gifted them with his garden, with his trees, with this earth. And now here the Lord blesses Noah and his sons. What he's saying is, I value you. You're very special to me. He showed them favor. And this isn't, we're not yet even into the covenant. This is as a human, as an image bearer of me, you have value. Every single person in this room today has this value. Every person that's out there walking who's not in this place today has that value. They've all been created in the image of God. We lose sight of that sometimes. He blesses him. And what does he give him? It's a desolate earth. He goes, this new, refreshed, cleansed earth, I give it to you. I give it to you for your use. I'm going to give you dominion here. He blessed them. In the ancient Hebrew, this word is linked to inheritance. It's linked to inheritance in the way that you give to the one that you care for what you have in order that when you're away from them, they will have benefit. Right? Who do you give your inheritance to? The people that you care about, the people who have value in your life, the things that you value, that's what you give inheritance to. Do you start to see this idea of blessing? When God blesses you, it's because you're special to him and you have value to him. And when he blesses you, he gives you his favor, he gives you his grace, he gives you his mercy. For those of us in the covenant, this new covenant, he gives us his son. God's blessings are often tied to his covenants with those that he sets apart for himself. And what you find is you've got this grace that he gives, and then on top of it, this grace that he gives, and on top of it, this grace that he gives. And so in all of creation, mankind, humans, have this additional grace. And amongst all of the humans, there's those that he has a covenant with that have even a more special grace. And you start to see how it rises. And so in these covenants with those that he sets apart for himself, God values them. And what you find in these covenants is you find both blessings for those in relationship who are keeping the covenant, but you also find in those covenants cursings for those out of relationship or breaking the covenant. You know what the cursings mean? It's for those out of relationship. The cursing is the removal of favor. The cursing is the withdrawing of the gifts. The taking away versus the giving unto. So in our opening verse this morning, we find verse 1 and 2 of Psalm 103, David says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits." What's David doing? Who's he talking to? He's talking to his own heart and mind. He's talking to himself, and he's saying, "Bless the Lord, O my soul." He's talking to his soul. I want with everything I have, with heart, mind, and soul, I want to kneel before this God. I want to show deference unto him. I want him to be the one who is special to me, the one who has the greatest value to me, the one that I give what I have. What does he have? You'll see in the rest of that psalm. He's got praise. He's got worship. He'll go and proclaim. He'll speak the truth. He gives his life. He holds God so cherished. He sees God as so worthy that he proclaims that he will give his all, his life, to the Lord. Why? Because the Lord has done so much for him and for his people. So don't just pass over the verse when we come to chapter 9. God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." God showed deference to them, and he lifted them. There's a sense that the Jews talk about the lifting, that he lifts them, and it's just not a normal value. Now you have a lifted value, this lifted value, because God has placed his love. He's placed a value upon you. And so he lifts them and he placed favor on them. In other places it says he lifts his countenance towards them. They were of great worth to him. You might think that after all that's occurred, God would put some stipulations about the next population increase. You know, the last 1,500 years didn't go so well. You would think if we were God, it's like, let's put some things in place to make sure it doesn't go so bad so quickly. Maybe let these sin-stained people die off. Grab another hunk of clay and mold a new one. It's not what God does. Why? Because his people were of great value to him. They were from the very beginning. They were in his mind before he created them. He had placed his love upon this people that were his. He loves them. This is what they come from. And in this valued race, there were people that he loved. There were folks that he would end up hating because of their sin. But there were people in this children of Adam and in the children of Noah that he dearly loved. Just think through your Old Testament. Adam fathered Abel, Seth, Enoch, Noah, Job, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, David, Sarah, Rachel, Leah, Hannah, Rahab, Mary. These that God loved were a part of this people that he so valued. And in this people that he so valued, there were these that he loved so much. And so God blessed the human race, which consisted of Noah and his family. He blessed the human race with his refreshed earth. Okay, here it is. Be fruitful. Fill it up. In the beginning, Adam and Eve were given dominion over the earth and its abundance, if you remember. And you remember the animals were brought to Adam to name them, and he would name them. And by naming them, there was a sense that he had sovereignty over them, that he ruled over them. And there was a sense that when he did this, that it wasn't hard for God to call them in. Even if you think of Noah bringing the animals as God drew the animals to Noah and they put them on this ark, you can see that there was a dominion and that there was this relationship between them. But Noah and his offspring are given dominion again. Just dominion, it means to have charge over, to be responsible for, to rule and to govern. But the world's a different place now, isn't it? It's desolate, still fallen, still suffering the effects of its corruption, the consequence of sin. And so to have dominion now is going to require some changes. Verse 2 gives you one of those changes. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every bird of the heavens, and upon everything that creeps on the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea. From now on, all of the other living creatures are going to be afraid of you, and they're going to flee from you in terror. That's something that changes. That wouldn't have worked prior to getting them on the ark, right? But now that they're off of the ark, now that they're moved into the surrounding area, this is what God places into the animal kingdom. They're going to be afraid of you, and they're going to flee in terror from you. And before this, there was a harmony. That harmony is shattered. We know that in the new earth and the new heavens, that harmony will be restored. But now in this period of time, as we live in the consequences of sin, they're afraid. From now on, animals will fear man. And verse 2, God says, into your hand they are delivered. Man's dominion now comes differently than it had before. And what you see in this verse, a lot of the commentaries bring out the idea that the animals, this animal kingdom, is given to man for man's use. It's placed under man's control. Uh-oh. Talk about that in a nice dinner party with your office mates. Come soon and see what that elicits. One of the consequences of the evolutionary theories is that if it's true, we're just another species on the planet. We're no more, we're no less, although many of them think we're less. They actually point to the dominion section of Scripture, and they berate this as a great reason to throw out Scripture and Christianity altogether. They hate that it places mankind above all of the other living creatures. This evolutionary theory they preach as their gospel. All species are equal in value. And what they do is they often point to mankind as the most vicious and the most dangerous of all of the species. The radical animal rights activists see the human race as the biggest problem on the earth today. They equate the killing of any animal as the moral equivalent to murder. That's where evolutionary theory brings you. The value's the same. I will tell you, though, what happens is as Christians, we often go too far defending the other side, and we go too far. In defending our position of man's dominion, we fail to see how wasteful we are. We fail to see how careless we are with this planet's resources. How cruel and heartless we can be. God cares about a swallow falling to the earth. Oughtn't we care about every animal life? We should. It doesn't have the same value as a human life, but it doesn't mean we don't care. Of all people, we ought to be the best, most ardent stewards of this planet and its abundant resources. We should be the caretakers. We should be the stewards. We've been given charge. I entrust it to your care. No, in defending this position, it's like, we can do everything we want. God will replenish it. God will do this. And we just do not look like good stewards at all. And if some of these that take these evolutionary theories as their gospel are uncomfortable with verse 2, they're completely taken over the edge with verse 3. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you now everything. You know what that means? It means there's nothing off limits for food. There's no dietary laws. Later you're going to see dietary laws brought in for his covenant people, but that is to set them apart. It's not. It has nothing to do with the food value. Too often people say, well, look at the dietary nutritional. No, it's about setting them apart. There's no dietary laws. Everything you can catch, because they're now going to be running from you, you can eat. Once death had entered the human race after the fall, I will tell you, going back in those past 1,500 years, was there no animals eaten? I think probably there were some. Think about it. There were a lot of folks far away from the Lord. Once death had entered the garden, there were people that were doing all kinds of wickedness. But here is where God now authorizes it. This is where it's now authorized. All creatures are given unto mankind to eat as food. You know, Dr. John MacArthur sometimes is a little harsh, but here's in a sermon on this passage, this is what he told his congregation. You need to put on a wool sweater, lace up your leather shoes, put on your silk shirt, grab your crocodile purse, and stick a feather in your hat. As you hook up the horses to your buggy to go out to eat and order the mixed grill of chicken, steak, and fish, be sure to start it with a salad. And when you give thanks to God for it, give thanks for the Noahic blessing. There is nothing taken off. But there is one stipulation. Look at verse 4. You shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. What it's saying is don't eat animals while they're still alive. Don't eat animals that are uncooked. Some take the idea, and they just kind of go scientific with it, I guess, and they say that it's because the people then didn't know what we know now about the parasites and the worms and all the living things that are in the blood that aren't good for us to eat, but God knew, and so God knew, and he protected them. I think that falls short, because right after the flood, that's not going to be true. It might be true later, but not here as much. I think the Jewish teachers provide a better reason for not eating the blood. And they take us to Leviticus chapter 17. I'm going to read a fairly lengthy portion. Leviticus 17, verse 10. If any one of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by the life. Therefore I have said to the people of Israel, no person among you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger who sojourns among you eat blood. Anyone also of the people of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them, who takes in hunting any beast or bird that may be eaten, shall pour out its blood and cover it with earth. For the life of every creature is its blood. Its blood is its life. Therefore I have said to the people of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any creature, for the life of every creature is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. And every person who eats what dies of itself or what's torn by a beast goes into a different section. So we're focused on the blood here. The life of all flesh is in its blood, both in humans and in animals. And what they point out to is that, first of all, there's a reminder that animals were not eaten at creation. These were all living creatures. All had value with the Lord. All of them had an intrinsic value because they were created by his hand and they were given life. And there's a link, this link between animals and humans through the fact that they both have life, both living creatures, both created with value. But then, because of that linkage of life, God has assigned the blood of this living creature to be used as the symbol, as the marker, this animal's blood to be a substitute for man's sin, pointing to the true atonement that would come when he gives his son. A life for a life was represented in the blood. I don't want you to forget that every life has value. We're using the blood of these animals as a marker for you, to the one day when I would send my son and his blood would be shed as a substitution for yours that deserves to be shed. Symbolic, was represented in the blood. God wants us never to forget that though this animal may be used for food, it's a living creature and its life matters to the Lord. I don't want to pass over that too lightly. We don't want to go where some of the radical folks have gone. But beloved, we do have to look at this and think, are we compassionate? Are we truly taking care of the animal kingdom around us? Are we using the resources responsibly, compassionately? It does matter. It matters to God. But more than the animals, these animals' blood is a substitution for man's blood. And even in that, you can see that this is a lesser to a greater. There is God's image placed upon humans. And although that animals have value, humans have a higher value. Humans have this value because they're made in the image of God. In Genesis 9:5, you see this picture. For your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. And so the Lord now moves from the value of animal life to the value of human life. Human life is sacred. I created every single human that has ever lived, ever will live. They are my creation, and every single one of them has been made in my image. Every one of them has value. I've placed the value upon them. Although mankind can now take animal life to consume, to survive, man's not to lose sight of the life of the animal given for him, right? The animal has value to God, but the blood spilled is to point to Christ's blood spilled for his human life that he's going to save, that he's going to send his own son as a ransom. This humans were created in a relationship with the living God. And so if an animal takes a human life, God will require a reckoning. We can take an animal life in order to eat, in order to feed ourselves. But if an animal takes our life, he's to be put to death. Don't eat him. Kill him. That's the command. That's not an animal to be eaten. That's an animal to be destroyed because he took a human life. In Leviticus, if an animal takes a life, they'll be killed, not eaten, life for life. If you are a farmer and your ox gores somebody and you don't put him to death and he gores someone else, you will be held for murder because you were commanded to kill the animal. And then for a human to murder another human, he says, oh, a reckoning will be required for the life of man. Verse 6 says, whenever the sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. The life of every human is sacred to God. This is the sanctity of human life. This is getting lost in all of our arguments that we're making with the world today. We're getting scientific, we're getting crafty, we're getting kind of gimmicky. The power is found here. Every human that's ever lived, even for a day, even for a moment, was created in the image of the living God. That's our fighting point. That's the hill that we die on. When one human sheds the blood and takes the life of another human who is an image bearer of God, a reckoning is required. And beloved, I have to take this opportunity this morning. I don't get many opportunities, and I'm taking the opportunity this morning to preach this out. Because right now in this culture, with the acceptance of evolutionary theory and the total rejection of God's creation and his sovereignty, we're now living in the result of that. We live in a culture and at a time where human life is no longer sacred. A human life is no longer considered of great value for its bearing the image of God. Today, you know where life's value comes from? It comes from how the life is lived. That's where life has value. It's in the quality of life, right? If the living is painful, it can be taken. If the living is costly, it can be taken. Even if the living is inconvenient, it can be taken. The quality of a life is now defined by man, not by God. Man defines now the value of a life, and that value continues to decrease year by year by year. We've forgotten that each life belongs to God. God's property, not ours. We are not our own. This is God's life. And if you take it, it will require a reckoning. He cares about a sparrow that falls to the ground. How do you think he cares for a little one? Right now as a church, we're praying for two couples who have a little one being formed in their womb. And we're praying for their salvation. I've already prayed for the husband or the wife. There's a life that has already begun. God is forming it right now. And right now, either two of these ladies, if it was inconvenient, and they didn't go to this church, they didn't have Christ, could very easily take the life away. Not today, not this month, not this year. Not ready. Not for me. Oops. It's my choice. Beloved, the sanctity of life must matter to us. Each life is of such value to the Lord. In Levitical law, if a mother was intentionally injured while she was pregnant and the baby was lost, the offender would be killed as a murderer. God makes no, it's not ambiguous. It's not hard to see clearly. David was a sinner in his mother's womb. All of these things we know. When does life begin? Here, I got one for you. You know where life began for all of us that are Calvinistic in our thinking? began before the foundations of the earth were laid is when a life began in the mind of our God, our living God, said, this is a life that I'm going to place here, and this one I'm going to place here. And you just took that life. A reckoning is required. When we lose sight of the value of life to God, all manner of violence occurs. It's not in the hundreds, beloved. It's not in the thousands. It's not in the millions. It's not even in the tens of millions. We're now up to the hundreds of millions of lives taken. Our God cares about one sparrow that falls to the ground. Trust me when I tell you, he cares about this. We must pray more for our country and the world. We must do more to be involved in the protection and the sanctity of human life. During the break, when you go down to fellowship, spend some time with Vicky, and I don't see her today, but you find Vicky, she's really involved in a couple of different things. I know Elliot and Jolene are. Ed's getting involved. A lot of our folks are getting involved. Talk downstairs around the coffee about things that matter this morning. Where can I get involved? I'm going to let you eat all the animals, he tells Noah and his sons. You can eat them all, but don't ever forget that they're a living creature that I made. And if one of them kills one of you, it needs to be killed, not eaten. And if, God forbid, one of you kills another one, a reckoning is required. I like verse 7. Be fruitful. Multiply, fill this place. I have so many, it's hard to come. Get busy. This morning, beloved, we come to the table and to once again remember that our God so loved us that he sent his son. And I want you to think about this. He sent his son for his son to shed his lifeblood as a substitute for ours. In the same way that Noah must have felt when he got off of the ark and everything is desolate. To get off the ark and to look at what God had just done in his judgment to all those. And to think, he saved me. I deserve that. But he loved me. Noah built an altar and he shed blood knowing that that's what I deserve. And he gave his all to the Lord. Beloved, we come to the table to recognize that God sent his son to shed his lifeblood as a substitute for our blood, which was required due to our sin. He sent his son to give his life as a ransom for ours, to pay for the death that our sin required, the reckoning that we required. Truly, we are blessed. Let's prepare our hearts for the table.